Hello and welcome to Roots of Today, the podcast where the past meets the present. With every episode, we journey through time, uncovering the lessons, parallels, and connections between historical milestones and current events to create a deeper understanding of the compelling stories and issues that shape the news. 80 years ago this week, two American bombers lifted off from an airfield on Tinian Island in the Western Pacific and flew into history. Each plane carried a single bomb, one codenamed Little Boy and the other codenamed Fat Man. These two separate attacks would mark the first and only time nuclear weapons have ever been used in war. For many Americans in 1945, the use of the atomic bomb seemed not just justified but necessary. A scientific miracle that ended the war quickly, spared countless American lives, and served as a powerful warning to future adversaries. President Harry S. Truman announced the Hiroshima bombing to the public with language that underscored triumph and righteousness. The bomb was a response to unprovoked aggression, a reign of ruin that had been brought on by Japan's own hand. But from the very beginning, there were dissenting voices. Some of the Manhattan Project's own scientists, including Leo Szilard and James Franck, urged restraint. Allied leaders such as Admiral William Leahy and General Dwight Eisenhower questioned the necessity of the bombings. In Japan and beyond, survivors of the bombings recounted the devastation in moral and human terms that clashed with triumphant official narratives. Today, the debate over the use of the atomic bomb is far from settled. What was once a largely accepted account, that the bombs were dropped to end the war swiftly and save lives, has been increasingly challenged by historians, ethicists, and international legal scholars. Critics argue that Japan was already seeking surrender, that the bombings were motivated by diplomatic posturing toward the Soviet Union, or that they constituted a war crime against civilians. Others counter that revisionist arguments ignore the brutal context of the Pacific War and downplay the enormous human cost of a conventional invasion. In this episode, we'll look at both sides of the debate and trace the evolution of thought from the confident justifications of 1945 to the more complex, divided assessments of today in a world where nuclear weapons not only exist but are much more powerful than the two dropped on Japan. This is Alan, your host, reminding you to grab your coffee, tea, or whatever beverage you desire so we can get started. In the early morning hours of August 6, 1945, the B-29 bomber Enola Gay lifted off from Tinian Island in the Mariana Islands. Commanded by Colonel Paul W. Tibbetts, Jr., the aircraft carried a crew of 12 men and a single bomb, Little Boy, the first nuclear weapon ever used in combat. The mission had been carefully planned and rehearsed for weeks. The primary target, Hiroshima, a city of over 300,000 people that housed military headquarters, industrial factories, and communication centers. Hiroshima had been largely spared from conventional bombing during the war, a deliberate choice by U.S. planners to preserve the city's infrastructure for atomic testing. At 8:15 a.m., with skies mostly clear and visibility ideal, bombardier Thomas Farabee released Little Boy from 31,000 feet. 43 seconds later, the bomb detonated approximately 1,900 feet above the Iui Bridge. The explosion produced a blinding flash and a fireball estimated at over 1,000,000 degrees Celsius at its center. Buildings within a 2-kilometer radius were flattened or incinerated. The shockwave and heat killed an estimated 70,000 people instantly. Many more died in the following days and months from burns, radiation sickness, and injuries. By the end of 1945, the death toll reached approximately 140,000. The American crew had trained extensively for the mission, but none were fully prepared for the aftermath. Looking back at the mushroom cloud, tail gunner Bob Caron described it as a swirling mass of purple-gray smoke. Colonel Tibbetts later recalled feeling pride in his mission's execution, but avoided discussing emotional reactions, emphasizing instead his duty as a soldier. There were no celebratory cheers aboard the aircraft, only silence and observation. 3 days later, on August 9th, a second B-29, Boxcar, departed from Tinian. This time, the mission was plagued with complications. The aircraft, piloted by Major Charles Sweeney, was originally assigned to target Kokura, a city with significant military production. However, heavy cloud cover and smoke from nearby bombings obscured visibility, forcing the crew to divert to the secondary target, Nagasaki. At 11:02 a.m., Fat Man, a plutonium-based bomb more powerful than Little Boy, was dropped through a break in the clouds. The bomb exploded about 1,650 feet above Nagasaki's Urakami Valley. Although Nagasaki's topography, with surrounding hills, partially contained the blast, the destruction was nonetheless catastrophic. An estimated 40,000 people died instantly. The death toll would rise to around 70,000 by year's end. The crew of Boxcar had faced fuel issues, miscommunication with the photography plane, and last-minute target changes. Despite the difficulties, they carried out their orders. Some later expressed mixed feelings. Flight engineer John Kuharek said, "We were all soldiers. We did what we were told." Both missions were deemed operational successes by the U.S. military. President Truman addressed the nation after the Hiroshima bombing, stating, "We have used it in order to shorten the agony of war." American newspapers praised the bomb's technological ingenuity and its role in bringing Japan to surrender. However, early American media coverage largely omitted images of the human suffering on the ground. The perspective of the bomb, crews, and military leadership dominated the narrative, framing the attacks as necessary, scientific, and even heroic. As the war ended on August 15th with Emperor Hirohito's surrender broadcast, the American public was largely supportive of the bombings, viewing them as the final decisive blow in a brutal conflict. Only gradually, through returning POWs, military memoirs, and international media, did questions begin to surface about the ethical implications and long-term consequences of atomic warfare. The arguments supporting the use of the bombs in 1945 are still strongly held by some Americans today. The most commonly cited justification in 1945 was the belief that the atomic bombs prevented a full-scale Allied invasion of Japan, known as Operation Downfall. Military planners estimated that such an invasion could have resulted in up to 1 million American casualties and several million Japanese deaths. President Truman, in his public and private remarks, emphasized this point. "The bombs ended the war, and that's what I wanted to do." The war in the Pacific had dragged on with extreme brutality. Examples included the battles of Iwo Jima and Okinawa, where Japanese resistance was fierce and civilian suicides were widespread. The bombings were viewed by American officials as the fastest route to unconditional Japanese surrender, which was crucial to avoiding a negotiated peace or partition. For some officials, including Secretary of State James Burns, the bomb was a geopolitical tool. The U.S. wanted to assert its global dominance, particularly to the Soviet Union, whose troops had just declared war on Japan and invaded Manchuria. Using the bomb before the Soviets could gain further influence in East Asia was seen as a strategic move. After nearly 4 years of bitter warfare and massive American losses in the Pacific, many U.S. citizens and soldiers saw the bombings as a form of justified retaliation. Japanese war crimes in China, the Philippines, and elsewhere, along with the attack on Pearl Harbor, had created a climate in which sympathy for Japanese civilians was limited. The Manhattan Project had cost over $2 billion, roughly $30 billion in today's dollars, and employed tens of thousands. Many in government believed that using the bomb validated the enormous investment of time, money, and intellectual effort. Not deploying it, in their view, would have been politically and scientifically unacceptable. But there were those in 1945 who felt the use of the bombs was either unnecessary or unusually cruel. For example, a growing body of wartime intelligence, including intercepted Japanese diplomatic messages, known as the Magic Intercepts, suggested that Japan was seeking ways to surrender, primarily if it could retain the emperor. Critics at the time argued that modifying the surrender terms might have ended the war without the need for atomic weapons. Also, even before the bombings, many prominent figures opposed the targeting of civilians. Admiral William Leahy, Truman's chief of staff, later wrote, "The use of this barbarous weapon was of no material assistance in our war against Japan." He and others believed the bombings violated long-standing principles of proportionality and civilian immunity. Several Manhattan Project scientists proposed a non-lethal demonstration of the bomb's power, such as detonating it over an uninhabited island, as a way to compel Japan's surrender without mass casualties. This idea, outlined in the Frank Report in June 1945, was ultimately rejected by military planners. Some contemporaries, including General Douglas MacArthur and Undersecretary of the Navy Ralph Bard, believed that the Soviet entry, not the bombs, would force Japan's surrender. The Soviet Union did invade Manchuria on August 8, 2 days after Hiroshima and 1 day before Nagasaki. Yet, while MacArthur and Bard believed that was the event that forced Japanese capitulation, there is also debate about the motives of Joseph Stalin, with some believing he knew the bombs would force a Japanese surrender and he was taking advantage, trying to grab as much territory as possible considering the circumstances. Finally, critics at the time argued that racism played a role. Dehumanizing portrayals of the Japanese in American media may have lowered the psychological threshold for mass civilian killing. In the decades since World War II, support for the use of the atomic bombs has persisted in both scholarly and public circles, though often in a more nuanced form. While fewer modern historians express unqualified approval, several still defend the bombings as a tragic but necessary act given the wartime context. Their arguments tend to focus on strategic necessity, historical realism, and the dangers of presentism. The most common argument in support for the bombings is the same one expressed in 1945, that is, dropping the bombs was a military necessity to avoid the human cost of an invasion. Modern pro-bomb scholars continue to emphasize the projected human cost of a land invasion of Japan. In the 2009 work, Hell to Pay, military historian D.M. Gengreco presents detailed analysis of Operation Downfall, showing that U.S. planners anticipated between 250,000 and 1 million American casualties, with up to 10 million Japanese deaths. He argues that the bombs, horrific as they were, ended the war quickly and saved more lives than they took. Similarly, Wilson D. Miss Campbell, in the 2011 book The Most Controversial Decision, writes that, in the absence of an effective alternative, the bombs were a legitimate strategic choice made by leaders operating under immense pressure. Proponents also see the deeply entrenched militarism of Japan's wartime government in 1945 as an impediment to a surrender. In Prompt and Utter Destruction, written in 1997, J. Samuel Walker argues that many Japanese leaders, particularly the Army faction, were prepared to fight to the death, even encouraging mass civilian resistance. The bombs, he contends, provided the psychological shock needed to overcome this intransigence, giving Emperor Hirohito political cover to surrender. It's also important to consider what had already happened to Japan's cities before the atomic bombs were dropped. By the summer of 1945, the United States had carried out an extensive and devastating firebombing campaign under General Curtis LeMay. Using low-altitude night raids with incendiary bombs, LeMay targeted densely populated urban areas built mostly of wood and paper. The most infamous of these raids was the firebombing of Tokyo in March 1945, which killed an estimated 100,000 people in a single night. More than died instantly in either Hiroshima or Nagasaki. By the time the atomic bomb was ready, most of Japan's major cities had already been reduced to rubble. According to some military planners, Hiroshima was targeted in part because it was one of the few urban centers that remained largely intact, allowing the bomb's destructive power to be clearly measured. From this perspective, some historians argue that the ethical threshold of mass civilian targeting had already been crossed well before August 6th. The atomic bomb, while novel in technology, was not a radical departure from what had already become accepted wartime practice. Total war aimed at civilian and industrial centers alike. In that context, the atomic bomb was seen not as a moral leap, but as a more efficient, if horrifying, continuation of an already brutal air campaign. For supporters of the decision, this challenges the view that Hiroshima and Nagasaki represented a uniquely immoral act, arguing instead that the alternative, prolonging the existing carnage, may have been even worse, Walker and others note that the firebombing of Tokyo, which killed more civilians than either Hiroshima or Nagasaki, and yet failed to move Japanese leaders toward peace. The atomic bomb, by contrast, ended the war within days. Modern defenders of the bomb also argue that no serious alternative was available in the moment. Demonstration bombs or altered surrender terms, they contend, were either rejected by Japan or politically unworkable. In his 1995 work, Truman and the Hiroshima Cult, historian Robert P. Newman critiques revisionist historians for what he calls armchair morality, arguing that they apply modern sensibilities to decisions made in a drastically different context. Moreover, some scholars argue that offering conditional surrender, such as retaining the emperor, was a diplomatic gamble that might have prolonged the war without guaranteeing peace. There is one other aspect to Truman's decision-making process that must be considered. Historians have long considered the political ramifications had President Truman decided against deploying atomic bombs and instead pursued a conventional invasion of Japan. Scholars like J. Samuel Walker emphasize that the American public's potential reaction to high casualty rates from an invasion, coupled with knowledge that nuclear weapons were available but withheld, could have sparked intense political backlash against Truman and his administration. Gar Alperovitz argues that the decision to use the bombs was influenced not only by military calculations, but also by the imperative to end the war swiftly to preserve Truman's political capital and maintain public support during a fragile post-war transition. The possibility of prolonged conflict with mounting American casualties risked undermining Truman's presidency and could have eroded confidence in his leadership. Furthermore, the secrecy surrounding the bomb's existence during the war limited public discourse, but had the information become widely known amid a costly invasion, media scrutiny and political criticism might have escalated dramatically. Thus, the use of atomic bombs can be seen as a strategic political choice designed to avoid the domestic and international consequences of a protracted ground war as much as a military necessity. In the summer of 1941, isolationist sentiment was very strong in the United States, even though the war had raged on in Europe for 2 years and in the Pacific for even longer. By 1945, Americans were bitter about having to fight a war that no one wanted to fight. Unlike every war the U.S. has been involved with since, World War II saw the nation undergo a total war effort. You could walk down any street in the U.S. and know which families had sons in harm's way and which had sons killed because people hung blue and gold stars in their windows to signify family members serving. Rationing was the rule everywhere. The amount of gas, rubber, shoes, silk, meat, or just about anything else imaginable that people could purchase was strictly controlled to ensure the troops had the material support they needed. In short, the war was a reality for everyone, not just from the news, but from daily existence. Refusing to use the bombs and allowing the war to drag on at all, let alone incurring a large number of U.S. casualties, could have caused a societal upheaval not seen since the end of the Civil War. Today, public opinion polls consistently show that a majority of Americans, especially older generations, still believe the use of the atomic bombs was justified. Many see the bombings as the culmination of years of sacrifice, trauma, and justified retaliation for Japanese aggression. While younger generations and global audiences are increasingly skeptical, defenders argue that any historical judgment must contend with the brutal reality of the Pacific War, not just idealized alternatives. Nevertheless, in the post-war decades, especially since the 1960s, an influential wave of scholarship and activism has increasingly challenged the official narrative surrounding Hiroshima and Nagasaki. These critiques draw on archival research, moral philosophy, Japanese testimonies, and Cold War analysis to argue that the bombings were neither necessary nor justified. A central revisionist claim is that Japan was seeking surrender through back-channel diplomacy well before August 1945. In Racing the Enemy, published in 2005, Tsuyoshi Hasegawa uses American, Japanese, and Soviet archival sources to show that Tokyo was actively pursuing negotiations, particularly with Moscow, as early as May 1945. He argues that the Japanese leadership was split and that U.S. insistence on unconditional surrender prolonged the war. Hasegawa also concludes that the decisive factor in Japan's actual surrender was not the atomic bombings, but the Soviet Union's surprise entry into the war on August 8th. This, he contends, shattered Japanese hopes for a mediated peace and forced surrender. Another key line of critique focuses on Truman's geopolitical motivations. Gar Alperovitz's The Decision to Use the Atomic Bomb, published in 1995, argues that the real goal was not ending the war per se, but demonstrating power to the Soviet Union at the dawn of the Cold War. The use of the bomb, Alperovitz contends, was as much about shaping the post-war world order as defeating Japan. Documents from the Interim Committee and post-war correspondence support the idea that high-level officials saw atomic diplomacy as a tool to limit Soviet influence in East Asia and Europe. Contemporary critics also emphasize the moral dimensions of the bombings, killing tens of thousands of civilians, many of them children, elderly, and non-combatants, is, for many scholars, indefensible under the laws of war and just war theory. Robert J. Lifton and Greg Mitchell's Hiroshima and America, published in 1996, argues that Americans have historically downplayed the suffering of Japanese victims, creating a national mythology that impedes honest reckoning. They point out that the bombings violated international norms, especially given that the U.S. had already firebombed over 60 Japanese cities. Revisionists also argue that viable alternatives to the bombings were available but deliberately rejected. These include modifying the demand for unconditional surrender, waiting for the Soviet invasion, and conducting a non-lethal demonstration of the bomb's power. The Frank Report, drafted by Manhattan Project scientists, explicitly urged a demonstration rather than use against civilians, warning that America's global reputation would be permanently damaged. Critics argue that political and military leaders prioritized expediency and prestige over diplomatic solutions that may have saved lives. The personal stories of Hibakusha, survivors of the bombings, have become increasingly central in modern scholarship and public remembrance. Works like The Atomic Bomb, Voices from Hiroshima and Nagasaki, by Selden and Selden in 1989, bring firsthand accounts of suffering, disfigurement, and radiation illness into the historical narrative. These voices challenge impersonal strategic analyses, placing the human cost front and center. Survivors' testimonies, often ignored in early U.S. historiography, have sparked international movements for nuclear disarmament and reframed Hiroshima and Nagasaki as moral tragedies rather than military triumphs. Furthermore, many critics argue that the atomic bombing set a dangerous precedent for nuclear warfare. As the world continues to live under the shadow of nuclear proliferation, Hiroshima has become a global symbol of the catastrophic potential of modern weapons. So where does that leave us? 80 years after the cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki were reduced to rubble in mere seconds, the debate over the atomic bombings remains deeply unresolved. What was once a matter of triumphant consensus in American public discourse has become a site of profound moral and historical reckoning. The central question, was the use of the bomb justified, has evolved into a broader inquiry. How do we weigh necessity against ethics in times of total war? What do we owe to the past, and how do we carry its lessons into an uncertain nuclear future? In 1945, the immediate context of the Pacific War gave many Americans little reason to doubt the bomb's use. It was seen as a grim but effective solution to a brutal conflict. Leaders like President Truman and General Groves defended their decision as one that saved lives, avoided a bloody invasion, and brought a swift end to hostilities. The American people, weary after years of sacrifice, largely agreed. For them, the atomic bomb was a symbol of victory, not a subject of shame. But even in that moment, there were cracks in the narrative. Dissenting scientists, skeptical generals, and quiet doubts about the necessity and morality of targeting civilians on such a scale. In the decades since, these voices have grown louder and more urgent. Historians have unearthed intelligence suggesting Japan's willingness to surrender. Ethicists have questioned the morality of obliterating entire cities, and survivors have shared stories that force us to confront the human cost of the decision. Modern scholarship now occupies a complex middle ground. Some argue the bombings were the least worst option among terrible choices. Others contend they were unnecessary acts of violence, shaped more by post-war politics than wartime necessity. Still others see them as the original sin of the nuclear age, a moment when the line between military action and mass extermination was irrevocably crossed. What has become increasingly clear is that the legacy of Hiroshima and Nagasaki is not confined to the past. It radiates outward, into debates about warfare, morality, race, technology, and international law. It reverberates in today's concerns about nuclear proliferation, the ethics of deterrence, and the power held by those who command weapons of mass destruction. For Japan, the bombings are remembered as national trauma, as cautionary tales, and as calls for peace. For the United States, they remain a deeply ambivalent symbol of scientific triumph and moral compromise, of victory and devastation. Globally, Hiroshima has become a shorthand for annihilation and a rallying cry for disarmament. Commemorating the 80th anniversary invites not just remembrance but responsibility. The survivors, many of whom are now in their 90s, continue to speak out, not out of hatred or vengeance, but to urge the world never to repeat what they lived through. Their testimonies, coupled with evolving historical scholarship, challenge us to move beyond binary thinking. The question is not only whether Truman was right or wrong, but whether we have learned anything from the unimaginable power that was unleashed that August. In reflecting on this anniversary, we are not merely revisiting a controversial wartime decision. We are engaging with one of the most profound turning points in human history, the moment when humanity acquired the means to destroy itself and chose, for better or worse, to use it. As we remember Hiroshima and Nagasaki, we are called not just to mourn, or to defend, or to debate, but to ask a more urgent question: what do we do now, knowing what we know, having seen what we've seen? The answer to that question, like the memory of those cities, belongs to all of us. That concludes this week's episode. If you find this podcast informative or entertaining, please like and subscribe on whatever platform you use to listen. The same goes if you tune in on YouTube. Also, if you have anything you would like to add to the conversation, or if there is a topic you would like to see covered on this show, please leave a comment. Until next time, remember this: get informed and fight to keep your political representatives accountable. Your freedom depends on it.